Good afternoon. I'm Sharon Leon from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. And I'd like to welcome you to today's Objective History audiocast. The Objective History is a joint project of the Center for History and New Media and the Smithsonian National Museum of American History to provide students and teachers around the country with a look at key objects from the collections. Our focus today is the desk on which Thomas Jefferson drafted the Declaration of Independence. We'll be talking about that document, its antecedents, and its changing interpretations. We're joined today by two guests who will answer your questions about the desk, the Revolution, and the early national period. First is Barbara Clark Smith, curator from the Division of Politics and Reform at NMAH. Barbara has worked extensively in early American history and has just worked on an exhibition about Jamestown, Quebec, Santa Fe in 1607, 1608, and 1609. And she's also curated After the Revolution, Everyday Life in America, 1780 to 1800. Our second guest today is Rosemarie Zagari, who is a professor of history at George Mason University. She's the author of numerous works on the revolutionary period, including Revolutionary Backlash, Women in Politics and Early American Republic, The Politics of Size, Representation in the United States, 1776 to 1850, and A Woman's Dilemma, Mercy Otis Warren and the American Revolution. We're going to start today with questions about the desk. You can join us and submit questions for our guests either through the website, objectivehistory.org, by going to the forum page and filling out the question form, or by email to teachers@objectivehistory.org. So our first question for today, I'd like to pose to Rosie. I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of what the population in the colonies looks like at the time in which this revolutionary fervor is happening. How many people? What's sort of the general profile of American colonies in comparison to, I don't know what, perhaps their brothers in England?
Okay. Well, there were about 2 million people in the 13 North American British colonies in 1776, and all of them, or almost all of them, lived east of the Appalachian Mountains. So that means within about 100 miles of the Atlantic Ocean. And there just hadn't been very much penetration beyond the Appalachian Mountains, partly due to the Indian menace, partly because there still was a fair amount of land available, except in New England, for people to cultivate in that region east of the Appalachians. Of those, about one-fifth or 20% of the population consists of African-American slaves. That's the highest proportion of African-Americans at any time in American history, 20%. Most of the people in the colonies, the majority were of British descent, but by the American Revolution, the majority were not recent immigrants. The 18th century had been a period of extremely rapid natural increase. That means that people were having a lot of babies and people were living longer. And so the population of the British colonies was doubling about once every 25 years. And that actually cheered people like Benjamin Franklin, who wrote a very important treatise documenting this in the 1750s, and it worried some people in Britain who wondered and thought about the time when the number of people in the British colonies in North America would outnumber those in Britain itself. So most of the people then in the colonies were of British descent, but not necessarily British immigrants, although there was an influx of British immigrants right before the Revolution. And some of those people, like Thomas Paine, did become very important in the revolutionary movement. There were some significant pockets of non-British population, especially in Pennsylvania. About one-third of the population of Pennsylvania consisted of Germans, many of whom did not even speak English. And this would become important because they really did not want to take sides during the American Revolution. So they sat things out to the extent that they could. So it's a population that, you know, you could say is overwhelmingly British, but not entirely. In the presence of slaves, the presence of non-British white people really complicated the matter for the American revolutionaries when they tried to wage war against Britain.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Barbara, you've done so much work on everyday life in America in the period after the Revolution. I'm wondering if you can share with us some sense of what it's like to curate material from that time period. What are the major challenges, the major interests, to look at the stuff that's not material from this exemplary, famous person?
Okay, sure. Well, I think the important thing to add to what Rosemary was saying about the population is that 90% of that population lived in rural areas, either on farms or in small rural villages or plantations, which doesn't necessarily mean great big tobacco plantations. Just it could be a small farm where they grow tobacco. They might call it a plantation. So most of the people are living in a rural setting, and the other 10% in towns and cities that are seaports, that are set along the coast generally, or up important rivers, such as Philadelphia being set up important rivers, but accessible to the ocean to carry the agricultural goods created by the farmers out to Europe. Tom Paine writes that Americans will always have a market in Europe so long as eating is the custom in Europe. And so they're always producing, besides tobacco, which is very important, grain, and they send out cattle and timber. And so there are people in the seaports who are artisans and who are sailors and who work in the mercantile trade. But most people's day-to-day life is a farm life. And all of these people's lives are ordered by the seasons. What the day-to-day work you do depends on the day-to-day jobs coming up in the growing season, whether it's time to plant, whether it's time to harvest. And we have artifacts that represent not only the sorts of houses and rooms that people lived in, but a lot of the tools that they used. Labor would be divided often by, of course, by class. It would be different if you were poor or enslaved what you would do than if you were well-to-do, but most people were sort of in the middle, and labor would be divided by gender. Men would do one kind of work and women another in an average farm. So we have artifacts that range from men's work, tools, hoes and plows and things like that, to women's work, which would be in dairying, pots and pans for cooking, anything to do with spinning yarn or making of fabrics. And then we have a lot of the very nice fashionable goods that skilled artisans made for people doing better and who wanted to have something fashionable. And artisans, especially in the cities, made those things. So we have a lot of the products of people's work, and I think that's a good way at the everyday life of most people.
Very good. This sort of brings me in a roundabout way to another question that we have from Matt from Virginia, and that is that I'm assuming the reason that Matt's asking this question is that so much of the emphasis on teaching the American Revolution is about the issue of taxes. And what he wants to know, and maybe we can start with you, Rosie, and then move to Barbara's, what are some of the reasons for declaring independence aside from the issue of taxes?
Yeah, that's a good question. And as the writer suggests, it's one that gets overlooked when students are often taught the Revolution. If you read the Declaration of Independence, you'll actually notice that there is only one line buried in the midst of the indictments against the king about taxing people without representation. And so what that suggests is that by 1776, taxation without representation is no longer the main or sole reason for the revolution. What's clear if you read the Declaration is that it's what Jefferson calls the long chain of abuses, the long train of abuses, excuse me. And what the colonists, and especially the leaders of the Patriot movement, wanted to emphasize is that taxation was only the beginning, that there was one policy after another that was imposed on the colonists that represented a breach of trust, that represented a violation of the colonists' rights, that represented the attempt of the British in the colonists' mind to reduce them to a state of what they called slavery or a complete and utter lack of their proper rights as subjects of Britain. So what are some of these other abuses? Things like dissolving their colonial legislatures. Each of the colonies had a representative assembly to which a substantial part of the male population elected representatives. And in many of the colonies, either the royal governors or in some cases Parliament itself had ended the meetings of those assemblies, and the colonists feared that. They thought it was a direct violation of one of their basic and fundamental rights. Some of the other things were things like not responding to the colonists' pleas for redress of their grievances. The colonists believed that one of their basic rights was the right to petition, and the Parliament and the Crown had consistently violated those rights, trying colonists who violated the Navigation Act in what were called admiralty courts. These are courts without juries, but which are courts in which just a naval officer or officers rules on the case, and which the colonists believe was a violation of their basic customary right of trial by jury. They were afraid that the existence of a standing army in places, especially like Boston, was a threat to their ability to be free citizens. There's a long tradition of opposition to having an army in peacetime, and as the Boston Massacre of 1770 had shown, that army could be turned against the civilian population. There were many, many other individual charges against the King and Parliament, but I think in the Continental Congress's mind, the most important thing they wanted to get across is that it was a series of abuses, repeated violations of trust without redress that had led to the declaring of independence.
And Barbara, is this list of repeated abuses, are these the same kinds of things that Tom Paine is raising for the general public in his writing?
Tom Paine, who's the author of the pamphlet Common Sense, which came out in January of 1776, he does talk about some of the abuses, but he's not so interested in just listing the things that the British have done wrong and that the king has done wrong. His pamphlet is so fascinating because it's hard for us to realize now how radical it was for people to imagine doing without the king. They had grown up with this monarchy, this king or his father. Other nations of Europe had monarchies. The monarch was just a normal part of government, and it was an important part of the British constitution, which the colonists, like the British at home, thought of as the best constitution, the most balanced, and full of the most rights and freedoms. And the king was part of that. And what Paine did, in addition to attacking the king for not taking care of, not defending his American subjects, but in fact sending armies amongst them and that sort of thing, he attacked the whole idea of monarchy and all hereditary power. he really asked the question, all right, maybe a group of people could get together and agree to be subject to or ruled by somebody during their lifetimes. But he asked the question, how could they get together and agree that their children should be ruled by this other person's children? And he makes fun a little bit of the idea that people should inherit power and someone should be king just because his father was king, or someone should be a lord just because his father was lord. And he points out often there's no guarantee that somebody who's smart and virtuous and a good ruler, that his children or grandchildren or descendants will be. So he does list things or include a group of grievances that Americans have, but he also gets them to, gets readers to think for the first time in many cases that maybe they don't, they can think of themselves, they don't need to think of only having a king as a necessary part. And if this king himself breaks the law, if the king himself fails to take care of them, if the king ignores all these complaints they've made through these petitions, then maybe he's not their king anymore, and they'll be better off without them.
That's very interesting. You know, it raises this talk of the right to hereditary rule raises a question of another matter of heredity, and that would be the institution of perpetual slavery, which Jefferson raises in his first draft of the Declaration. Rosie, I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about the role that the question of slavery plays in the minds of the founders and the drafters when they're thinking about raising a case for independence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think one of the most interesting things for students to do is to look at the draft of the Declaration, which is on the website, and to see that paragraph that was cut out beginning, "He has waged cruel war against human nature itself," which is all about slavery and the slave trade, and accuses the king of instituting the slave trade and of not allowing the colonists to abolish it. And Jefferson put it in there, and the Continental Congress cut it out, partly for political reasons, because the Southerners would never assent to a document like that. But I think the larger issues are these. We have to remember that at the time of the American Revolution, slavery existed in all of the colonies. It was not the so-called peculiar institution of the South. It was admittedly much more important to the economy of the South. That means colonies like Maryland and Virginia and South Carolina particularly. But even in cities like New York and Philadelphia, almost as much as 20% of the population of those cities consisted of slaves. And even in Massachusetts, you had 2-3% of the population of slaves. So slavery was not confined to a particular region. And one of the most interesting things about slavery is that the organized opposition to slavery really did not begin to gain any momentum in the colonies until at least the 1750s. So that's not so far before the American Revolution. And the leaders of that opposition were Quakers, and their opposition was based on their religious principles, which believed in the radical equality of all people and of the moral violation, the moral sin they believed that slavery slavery compelled on slave owners and the slaves. So there's really not a strong or widespread organized anti-slavery movement at the time of the American Revolution. There are just these glimmerings of resistance to the institution. What is so interesting about the American Revolution is that the rhetoric that the Americans used in opposing Britain was the rhetoric of slavery. that British policies were reducing the colonists to the condition of slavery. And that was a trope that was very common in British political philosophy, but for the American colonists, it really had a resonance that it didn't in Britain, because they saw slaves. They probably knew people who owned slaves if they didn't own them themselves. And they could witness very vividly the effects of losing all of your freedoms, including your freedom over your own body, which is what chattel slavery is. So that rhetoric, which was initially deployed against Britain strictly for the purposes of attaining political freedom, had a wider meaning in the colonies because of the existence of slavery. Now, and then, of course, after the Revolution, this contradiction becomes the contradiction between freedom for white people and slavery for African Americans becomes more pronounced, and the contradictions produce the beginnings of more organized anti-slavery movements. But it's really the Revolution that brings that contradiction to the fore. One of the things that had happened, though, in the decade prior to the American Revolution was a boycott of the slave trade, and that was undertaken as a way of hurting British shipping. The high-minded motives may have not been paramount when the Stamp Act Congress or the various colonial legislatures attempted to implement that. The idea was really more to damage British shipping, which carried the slaves. So what you see happening is that the whole rhetoric of slavery gets used by white Americans, but then in the context of a slave-owning American society, then gets turned against those slave owners as they have to face the contradiction between slavery for blacks and freedom for whites. And I should note that the British themselves were among the first to point out that Americans were slaves, as they say, yelp loudest for their freedom. And they pointed out the hypocrisy, as they called it, in the American position.
Very good. Barbara, I'm wondering, in your work in the collections on early American life, is there a lot of attention to slavery and slaveholding in this question in the collections?
In the collections, certainly by the time that you begin to get organized anti-slavery movements, which produce documents, produce pamphlets and sermons and articles that are published, that sort of thing we do have in the collection. And many archives, historical archives around the East Coast in particular, have that sort of thing in their collections. It's only in the early 19th century, though, that you begin to get a fair number of anti-slavery artifacts, that is, maybe jewelry, maybe pins, maybe banners, the sorts of things that go along with political organization. There are early anti-slavery sentiments, but they don't show up too much in artifacts, and that's one of the difficulties of working with the museum collection. We can really show ordinary life, but a lot of political issues, it's only when they get articulated at a particular moment, raised, say, the Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society, which is the first one, I think, founded in the colonies. That was founded in 1774, and two of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were part of that, Benjamin Franklin and Benjamin Rush, both Pennsylvanians. So that organization generates material, membership badges, and things like that. So we do have some of those things to document early anti-slavery. But that kind of movement doesn't tend to show up in lots of artifacts until it's a very widespread movement. What I think is interesting, Sharon, is one of the things you're getting at is the question so many people have is, how do you combine this all men are created equal idea and this slavery idea? And I think it's just very useful to know that the Congress as a whole wasn't agreed on that. There were these individuals who were opposed to slavery, but there are many individuals who relied on slavery, and there were individuals who didn't feel that strongly about it. And the Declaration wasn't an occasion for changing institutions inside the colonies or inside America. That wasn't what they thought they were doing. They thought they were making their clear case about their grievances against George III. But once they got thinking about all these issues, what was slavery? What was oppression? What was freedom? What rights do people have? Why do people have those rights? Then they started thinking much further than they thought, had originally thought, and they found other people, and certainly many African Americans in particular, thought further than the people who had first written about all men are created equal, had imagined it would go. And a lot of African Americans started saying, wait a minute, you're talking about political rights. What about our political rights? And that question got opened up for many, many Americans, African American and European American, by this document and the language that it used and the way that it engaged people's imagination about not just what America was, but what it could be, what it might mean for people to say all men are created equal.
Very good. Part of the reason I asked that question about the representation of early abolition and early instances of slavery in the collection is I was wondering if there has ever been a move within the museum to try and think about what an exhibit may be centered around that concept of the changing meaning or contestation about the phrase all men are created equal would look like. It would include the Jefferson desk, but I'm sure that there are a host of other things that would be included in an exhibit like that if there had been a move amongst curators to think about exhibits along those lines, a thematic, intellectually thematic exhibit like that.
Well, that would be a fabulous exhibit, and it would bring you all the way up to the present. You really could go from these words in Jefferson's draft, and then in the Declaration adopted by the founders, and then you could see the way very quickly in various of the northern states, for example, people start applying this. There's a lawsuit in Massachusetts because the Massachusetts Constitution, I think of 1780, includes the phrase, all men are created equal, and there's a group of enslaved Africans in Massachusetts, helped by free white lawyers, go to court and say, doesn't that mean we're free? And so that results in part in the abolition of slavery in the state of Massachusetts. And that phrase gets picked up then in later years by the women's movement, and I think that's represented on the website by the statement of the Seneca Falls Declaration, where women are saying, well, maybe it isn't just all men. Maybe it's all men and women are created equal. And then, of course, probably the person who does the most with that phrase, all men created equal, might have been a later president, Abraham Lincoln, who embodies this notion of all men being created equal in his understanding of the Civil War, what the war for union is about, and in his Gettysburg Address. And I think it would be fascinating to then take particularly that time period, but then also carry it up and show how people have used that issue of what do you mean all men are created equal? What does that really mean for us? And are we willing to follow our ideals where they seem to lead us?
Very good. I'm wondering, Rosie, if in thinking about the ways in which this phrase has moved through history and been reinterpreted along the way, would the Committee of Five have imagined that this document, the Declaration, you know, we've got Jefferson in his room in Philadelphia working on this, and then his editors helping him with it, that it was going to have this type of intellectual heritage and life in the nation in the future? Or was it going to be a sort of utilitarian document that was going to make their case? The case was going to be made. Independence has been declared. And then it would sift into the background?
Well, I doubt that any of the Committee of Five, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Robert Livingston, Roger Sherman, or even Jefferson himself, imagined the future uses to which the Declaration would be put. Having said that, what's interesting is the way that you can see John Adams and Thomas Jefferson face off and dispute the use of the Declaration by the 1790s, because Adams becomes what you might call political conservative, and in his mind, the Declaration was what you said, a utilitarian document that was expedient for the explicit purpose of declaring independence against Britain. And once its work was done in that regard, then its use was over. Jefferson, particularly after the French Revolution began in 1789, and the French picked up on a lot of the language of the Declaration of Independence in their own Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, and Jefferson really began to see the larger and much more utopian purposes of the document, and he and his political supporters began to use the Declaration of Independence as kind of the basis for the agenda of their political party, which was to expand the rights and privileges not just of men who owned property, but of all white men. And so he was much more willing to read and to have an expansionistic or an expanding interpretation, a looser interpretation, if you will, of the meaning of the Declaration than John Adams and his Federalist supporters were. They found that whole notion of rights of man to be dangerous, the whole notion of natural rights to lead to, you know, demands by larger and larger groups of people, including women and black people, for rights, which they found, the whole idea of which they found abhorrent. And so the Federalists, the conservatives, really wanted to suppress that aspect of the Revolution, while the Jeffersonians wanted to build on it and celebrate it. Having said that, I will say that the Jeffersonians, even though they continued to use that rhetoric of rights of man, never were in favor of expanding the political rights of women to include the vote or holding public office, and only very spottily were they in favor of allowing free blacks to vote. There are a few states in the early national period where free blacks vote, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, maybe one or two others. So briefly, free blacks did have some rights, but then by the 1830s or later, they were stripped of those rights. So the Jeffersonians' agenda, their whole notion of the meaning of the Declaration, was really directed toward what it meant for white males rather than for the whole population, which is what's implicit in the rhetoric.
Yeah, we have a follow-up to that, Rosie. We have a question here from a student, Brianna in Georgia, who wanted to know, in fact, why women weren't given the right to vote at the time of the Revolution.
Hmm. Well, in one place they actually could vote, and that was New Jersey. And what's interesting is under the New Jersey Constitution, as in other places, you had to own a certain amount of property in order to vote, but it was not specified that only males could vote. And in New Jersey in 1790 and then in 1797, the state legislature passed election laws that specified and called voters he and she. And we do have records of women voting in New Jersey. but I should say it's a very limited segment of the female population that was even eligible to vote in New Jersey, because married women could not own property, and the women that were most likely to be able to meet the property qualification for voting in New Jersey were probably wealthy widows. So in any given election, no more than a few hundred of these wealthy widows probably voted. But what's interesting is New Jersey legislators seem to have expanded the vote to women because of the logic of the revolutionary rhetoric, not the rights of man rhetoric, I should say, but the no taxation without representation rhetoric, because women, wealthy women who owned property had to pay taxes. And so the question was, well, if you were a woman who paid taxes, shouldn't you be allowed to vote? Mm-hmm. And so in New Jersey, they did, but only briefly. And in 1807, the vote was taken away from women, along with free blacks who also voted there briefly for a short time. And I just want to contrast that to the demands that Jeffersonians made for the expansion of suffrage, of the vote, to all white males, where they were arguing for the elimination of property qualifications and wealth as a basis of voting, and instead said it was a natural right, that it belonged to all people, by which they meant men, simply because they were people. So what you have in New Jersey is this rare example of a state following the revolutionary principles, but then sort of having second thoughts about it and taking the vote away from women. But it is a very extraordinary example of the power of that revolutionary rhetoric at the time.
That's fascinating. Barbara, we've talked a lot about the sort of intellectual life of the document. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the life of the object, the life of the desk, and where it goes after Jefferson drafts the Declaration, and how it makes its way into the Smithsonian's collection.
Okay, sure. And it's interesting because the importance of the desk, or what happens to it, is a little bit, it parallels a little bit what Rosie was saying about the importance of the Declaration of Independence, that at least at first, it's okay, I used the desk, I wrote this on it, but it doesn't make that desk particularly important. There's no particular sense that anybody's interested in it. And Jefferson presumably uses it to write letters and all kinds of other things on when he's traveling. And it's only some years later, and particularly in the early 1820s, that there begins to be a big renewal of interest in the revolutionary era, and many people realize the revolutionary generation is dying off. They're losing people who remember the Declaration and the Revolution, and so they start wanting to save memories and save artifacts or houses or places related to that. And so in the 1820s, Jefferson starts getting letters from people and being addressed by people in conversation saying, tell me more about when you wrote the signing of the Declaration. And, for example, we have there's a letter from a Dr. James Neese from 1825, and it's almost the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration. Right, so that's going to be a celebration, and people are now interested in it. And Neese writes to Jefferson and says, well, where exactly did you live, and what room exactly did you sit in when you wrote this this Declaration draft? And so Jefferson begins to realize that there is a value, that people are looking for these relics, and that they're considered valuable in a sentimental and patriotic way. And he uses the term, he talks about the superstitious value of things connected with this time of the Declaration. I don't think he means to be negative or critical when he says superstitious. I think he just means people give meaning to things associated with a particular individual or time. So he begins to realize that. And when his granddaughter gets married to a man named Joseph Coolidge, they have a whole group of wedding gifts, which unfortunately are lost when a ship has an accident, and he decides to give them the desk as a kind of wedding present and a relic of the time when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. And he realizes this may make this desk valuable. I don't know that he means in terms of money, just valued and something that people want to see and want to be associated with. So he gives that to his the granddaughter and her new husband, Joseph Coolidge, and then towards the end of their lives, the Coolidges donate it to the U.S. government. And it was first held by the State Department for a while and then handed off to the National Museum late in the 19th century. And what we have, in 1921, it entered the National Museum collection after being in the State Department since about 1880. So we have connected with the desk a group of letters, one written by Jefferson himself saying, this is the desk that I wrote that draft on, and letters to his granddaughter and her new husband, and then letters from that family, the Coolidge family, saying, this is the desk we received, and records of it since it came to the State Department and the National Museum. So since 1921, it's been in the National Museum, often on exhibition, although often not, because it's wood and fragile and deteriorates when shown to the light, so we can only exhibit it so much, but I think we have a pretty direct record of its coming and increasingly being valued, the same way the Declaration itself comes to be valued and seen in different ways. I think the desk represents a relic that wasn't really important at the beginning, but then Jefferson and later people realized it might be something other people would really care about and give value to as the connected with the Declaration of Independence.
Very good. I want to give you both an opportunity to have perhaps a closing thought on both the creation of the Declaration on this desk and as a founding document, and the legacy of the document for the country. But particularly, if there's something that you think is of value to our target audience here, which is, you know, sort of 11th grade American history students. Rosie, if there's something particular that you think that they should walk away from their studies of this time with?
Well, that it isn't just a bunch of dead words that happened far in the past, and that I think studying the Declaration and the way it's had so much resonance and impact over time is just one of the best reasons to study history. I mean, it just shows you that, you know, what happened over 200 years ago really still has meaning and influence today. So I just think that I hope students can get past the funny-sounding language or the strange terms and ideas to really see what's important and, you know, to not be caught up in just the minutia of it, but to understand that these ideas have a power that extends beyond the time in which the document itself was written and beyond the individuals themselves who wrote the document.
Very good. And Barbara, perhaps a closing thought from you on this?
Right. Well, I think that's very moving and very true. And I would add, I guess, two things. One is, I think it's worth pointing out that these basic questions that are raised in the Declaration of Independence do still have relevance, and the issue of the legitimate rule of a monarch or any executive, and whether the executive follows the law, and who, or
the proper balance between the executive and the Congress that's making the law or the legislature that's making the law. We're still debating that today. So this is not a completely settled issue. The other thing I think is really important is we tend to think of the Declaration of Independence as having an author, Thomas Jefferson. You know, and if you're on Jeopardy, that's the correct answer. Who's the author? Thomas Jefferson. Well, sure. But it's very important to know he wrote the draft. He wrote what other people wanted him to write. They edited it. The whole Continental Congress agreed to it. They were all the author. And then it wouldn't have mattered that the whole Continental Congress agreed to it if the American people hadn't agreed to it. So there's a way in which all the people involved, all the ones who sign up for their militia or the Continental Army, all the ones who agree to sacrifice economically to try to support the Army during the Revolutionary War, all the ones who take a chance on thinking through, maybe this means I have to free slaves, maybe this means I have to change the way I live. All of those people, those are the real authors. And I think it's very important to understand about history that it's not enough for a few men who write really well, and Jefferson wrote really well, to write some beautiful words. Those words have to be moving in the hearts of a lot of people. And I think that Jefferson himself was inspired by many others and the people around him. So it's very important, I think of the Declaration as not just the product of one man or a small group of men or this group of leaders. It's the product of a whole lot of people individually kind of going beyond where they'd been taught to go and thinking further. And that, to me, is a tremendously valuable example to us today.
Barbara, that's a wonderful note for us to end on. I want to thank Barbara Clark-Smith and Rosemary Zagari for their time and a really fascinating conversation today. And I want to urge our listeners to join us again next month when we talk about the gold nugget that launched the 1848 gold rush. Thank you for joining us in exploring the object of history.